Well, this morning we're going to turn back over to Acts chapter 25, although we're going to have a brief look at chapter 24 again as a means of review. Last week we began the story of Acts in Paul's Roman trials, and we saw him come before Felix. And we left Paul when Governor Felix was replaced by a new governor, a fellow named Porcius Festus. Now, Paul had been faithful to proclaim Jesus Christ even when he was treated unjustly, as he had been by Felix. In fact, Paul should have been released when he arrived in Caesarea. When Lysias, the commander, had sent Paul down to Caesarea, he had sent with him a letter explaining to Felix, the governor, exactly what had gone on as he understood it. And in the things that he said that Paul had committed no crime worthy of death or even imprisonment, although there was a religious question. But there was nothing worthy of death or even imprisonment. Paul should have been released right then. Instead, Felix decided he would wait until the Sanhedrin, or at least elders from the Sanhedrin, some representatives, the chief priest Ananias and a lawyer named Tertullus came down and let them accuse Paul, which they did. They accused Paul of treason, of religious heresy, and temple desecration. Felix then let Paul defend himself, and Paul defended himself very well. Paul was not guilty of any of the charges. He refuted every single one of them. The charge of treason he refuted because he says, I've only been in Jerusalem 12 days, and five of those I was in prison. I haven't had time enough to create what they're charging me with. In addition, there are no witnesses of me causing a riot or even having a seditious conversation with anybody. They have no proof. I'm not guilty of religious heresy. The sect, the way, which they consider a sect anyways, is not illegal. That was their accusation. It is thoroughly rooted in Judaism, and it has the exact same hope as all the other branches of Judaism. It is just as Jewish as they are, and therefore protected under Roman law. Under the third charge of temple desecration, he says that's impossible because I was actually in the temple bringing alms, presenting offerings, and undergoing a purification rite. I was giving honor to the temple, not desecrating it, because each of those things are things that must be done in the temple. So I'm not guilty on any of these things. He refuted every single charge. And then he launched his own attack and saying that the ones who caused the problem are certain Asian Jews who haven't bothered to come. They caused the turmoil. They caused the riot. Now, this was plenty of evidence for Felix to have released Paul again right then. Instead, he decides that he's going to wait until Lysias, the commander, can come down personally. But now we are 2 years later. Paul is still in prison. Felix has not carried out what he had said for one reason or another. We do know from 24 verse 26 that Felix wanted a bribe, and they also wanted to do the Jews a favor for his own benefit. Scratch their back, they'd scratch his. They wouldn't cause as much problems. So Paul had received much injustice at the hands of the governor, Felix. And yet Paul, in the midst of that, took every opportunity to proclaim the Lord Jesus Christ despite it. He explained to Felix and Drusilla, his wife, faith in Jesus Christ. That's what they wanted to know. What did he do? He proclaimed to them righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come. The greater tragedy here really is not that Felix kept Paul in prison. The greater tragedy is Felix had the opportunity over 2 years to hear the truth, and he did, for the text tells us he sought Paul out and heard him many times. He never heeded what Paul had to say. He's like so many today. He was curious, but he was never serious about what the truth was. Now, as we begin our examination of Acts 25, Paul is now under the custody of a new Roman governor, Porcius Festus, and he is again going to demonstrate this same kind of commitment to live a life with a conscience clean before God and before men, as well as taking advantage of every single opportunity to proclaim the truth to anybody who would listen. And in these cases, those are the most powerful in the land. Acts 25, verse 1. Festus, therefore, having arrived in the province, 3 days later went up to Jerusalem from Caesarea. Now, we quickly find out Festus has a very different character than the previous governor, Felix. Now, this is both a positive and a negative. On the positive side, we're going to see that Festus takes action quickly. On the negative side, we're going to find he's a bit ignorant. But their character is borne out by, really, their backgrounds. Felix rose up and climbed the political ladder the hard way. He actually began as a freed slave and ends up as a governor. He achieved a lot in his life. But in the process of doing that, he learned how to manipulate things to his advantage, even if it meant having to do something that was evil. He was greedy, and he continually delayed his decision concerning Paul, in part because it fit his political manipulations, and in part because he wanted a bribe from Paul. He wasn't a good character. Now, Festus, on the other hand, was from a noble family, and he was known to be wise, he was known to be honorable. He was diligent. He would take action. He would do whatever investigations he had to find out and make a decision and take action. Felix was always procrastinating. So here we find he's been in Judea only 3 days, and he understands already, if I'm going to be a successful ruler, I need to understand this nation, these people, and especially I need to curry somehow the favor of the religious and civic leaders who are based in Jerusalem, so we can bring peace back into this province. Remember, I had said at the end of Felix's reign, it had been much turmoil. It was not a safe place to be. There were assassins all over the place. If you were pro-Roman in any sense, and you were out in the country, you well could be murdered wherever you were. Much, much turmoil. So Festus wants to bring peace back. So off he goes to Jerusalem to seek the cooperation of these Jewish leaders. Now, all those are good character traits, but there's one thing, again, he lacked, and that was knowledge and experience of Jewish affairs. And if he wasn't careful, he would end up finding himself being manipulated the same way that previous Roman governors and procurators had been, and almost all of them had been manipulated by these Jewish leaders. Verse 2. And the chief priests and the leading men of the Jews brought charges against Paul, and they were urging him, requesting a concession against Paul, that he might have him brought to Jerusalem. And then Luke adds in here in parentheses for us what was behind it. At the same time, setting an ambush to kill him on the way. They hadn't changed at all, had they? Here is a new governor. He's brand new, and there are so many things you would need to discuss with a new governor. And the top priority they still have in their minds, we've got to kill Paul. We've got to get rid of this guy. 2 years later, and that's still their top priority. Luke tells us again the particular reason they requested this change in location for a trial is because they wanted to ambush him. That was the plan 2 years earlier. They still have it. Now, the request has a certain logic to it, and they thought Festus would go for this. Festus, you're already here in Jerusalem. You send for Paul, he'll come, we'll hold the trial here, it'll be convenient for you. However, in God's providence, Festus had other plans. And instead, he invites them to come down to Caesarea, and they can prosecute Paul there. In other words, if they really want to have this done quickly, they're going to have to fit in with the governor's schedule. And the governor's schedule is not going to be hanging around Jerusalem for a long time, waiting for Paul to finally come up. Because remember, they didn't have telephones. No wireless, nothing. You have to send a guy physically, take your message down there, and it's 60 miles, and then the guy's got to come back. He doesn't want to wait around for that. So verse 4 says, Festus then answered that Paul was being kept in custody at Caesarea, and he himself was about to leave shortly. Therefore, he said, let the influential men among you go there with me. If there's anything wrong about the man, let them prosecute him. So since he's going back, and Paul's under guard, you stick with my schedule. So they do accompany him down. Verse 6. And after he had spent not more than 8 or 10 days among them, he went down to Caesarea. And on the next day he took his seat on the tribunal and ordered Paul to be brought. After he had arrived, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood around him, bringing many and serious charges against him, which they could not prove. So Festus doesn't let the grass grow under his feet, does he? He completes his initial business in Jerusalem, returns to Caesarea, and in only a week and a half he accomplishes all this. He's been in the country less than 2 weeks, and he's already charged ahead full steam to fulfill his responsibility as governor. This is a man of good character. But again, the Jews accept his invitation. They return with him. And again, he's not going to wait around. Okay, this is serious business. We'll have the trial tomorrow. And that's what he sets up. So Festus takes his place in the seat of the judge. This is Bema. So it is in the place of the judge. This is a trial. Paul is once again placed in the position of being the accused. And these Jewish leaders are once again in the position of being his accusers. Now, as soon as Paul comes in, they begin to accuse him before the governor with, it says, many serious charges. Now, the physical aspect of this didn't help. The text gives us the idea that as Paul comes in, these guys physically surround him and are berating him and accusing them in front of the governor. That doesn't help any. That would make them more aggressive, and it certainly increases all the tension to have them face-to-face and surrounding the one accused rather than having some separation. Well, Luke does not go into detail this time. We assume the charges are going to be the same or similar to those made 2 years earlier. Treason, being the leader of an illegal religious sect, and that he had desecrated the temple. But even though they've had 2 years to prepare, there's still no witnesses. There is still no proof for any of the charges. That's pretty poor planning. You'd think in 2 years they would have bribed somebody to at least give a false witness. They haven't even done that. There's nothing to the charges. Luke summarizes Paul's offense there in verse 8. While Paul said in his own defense, I have committed no offense either against the law of the Jews or against the temple or against Caesar. So as the accusations are being made, Paul is actively refuting them as they are made. The verb tense here is not that all the charges are laid out and then Paul refutes them. It's this time it's one and back and forth. It's going back and forth in probably an argument, loud discussion in front of the governor. He's watching all this. But again, he had done nothing against the law of the Jews. He had not done anything against the temple. He had not violated any Roman law. He had done nothing against Caesar. And last week we went into detail about how Paul defended himself, so you can either pick up the tape or get the sermon notes from that, and you can see exactly how he defended himself. He was not guilty. There was no proof of anything he'd done wrong. Now this puts Festus in quite a predicament. He's got a dilemma now. Paul is a Roman citizen. He has violated no Roman laws. Festus is responsible to protect this man. At the same time, something has happened that has caused these Jewish leaders to hate this man with a supreme hatred. And I don't know how else you describe it. 2 years later, they still want him dead. They hate the man. All Festus understands is it has something to do with their religion, and he doesn't understand that at all. What is going on here? He is still trying to figure out the issue, the dynamics of the province he has been set to govern. He doesn't understand it, and so he sees this as an opportunity. Maybe he can get some understanding of these people and this religion if he does something different. Something he should not have done, but verse 9, he asks a question of Paul. But Festus, wishing to do the Jews a favor, that's that aspect, he wants to understand them. Remember, he's new in the province, he needs their help. He answered Paul and said, are you willing to go up to Jerusalem and stand trial before me on these charges? Okay? Basically saying, I don't understand what's going on here. I'd like to go to Jerusalem, and there, since it's the center of Jewish influence, that's where the Sanhedrin is. That's where the chief priests are. Someone's going to be able to explain this to me. But I will be the one who is going to be in charge. Now, it would have seemed reasonable for him to do that. That is reasonable for him on his part. A good compromise. I'll get what I need. It's also a favorable concession to the Jewish leaders. So it is a favor to them. They wanted it in Jerusalem to begin with. Okay, we'll go there and do it there. They'll be pleased. I'll get an understanding. And since it's still before me, a Roman governor, we should be happy. Now, Festus thinks that is enough for Paul. Paul, you're going to be in trial before me, i.e., it's still a Roman court. That's going to be your protection. That, however, brings no comfort to Paul. None. Because Paul knew the region, He knew the religion, and he knew these rascals that were accusing him. He knew what was going on. He knew how manipulative they were. Festus made this proposal because he was ignorant. It didn't come out of a bad carrot. He was just ignorant of what the possibilities were. Now note, Festus is asking. He didn't order him. He didn't demand. There is no legal basis for another trial. The trial has just been held. The information's already been there. There's been no proof given. And it's hard to come up with a reason that he would think this proposal would be of any benefit to Paul, except maybe if Paul agrees, he can get over this quicker. I'll finally get this done with, and I'll finally be out of jail. That's about it. There's no benefit to Paul. In fact, from Paul's point of view, there are several different outcomes that are possible. None of them are good. What are they? Well, first of all, remember Paul knew about the first ambush? It's reasonable to assume he would think they're doing the same thing. He knows if this happens, he may never make it to Jerusalem. He'll be ambushed on the way and murdered. That's not good. Second, he knows that if Festus goes there, he's going to get a biased hearing because the Sanhedrin will probably become his counsel, because part of it is he doesn't understand the religion, so who better to ask than the Jewish religious leaders who are biased? And if that's his counsel, he's condemned before the thing even starts. The third thing that could happen, because remember, he doesn't know Festus, doesn't know anything about his character, is Festus just could condemn him to gain favor of the Jews. Okay, I see you guys are really upset about that. Hey, what's one man in terms of the whole nation? I'll sacrifice this guy and at least we'll have peace. That's a possibility. That's not good. Or what happens if Festus frees him? You're not guilty. You are free. Now what? Paul has been protected by the Roman military. What happens if you're in Jerusalem and you're no longer protected? Paul goes out on the streets, he'll be assassinated. No possibility is good here for Paul. He understands this. And so, verse 10, we find that Paul will not concede to the request. Paul said, I am standing before Caesar's tribunal where I ought to be tried. I have done no wrong to the Jews, as you also very well know. If then I am a wrongdoer and I have committed anything worthy of death, I do not refuse to die. But if none of those things is true, of which these men accuse me, no one can hand me over to them. I appeal to Caesar. Then when Festus had conferred with his counsel, he answered, you have appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you shall go. Now Paul points out, he was already in the proper court. There's no need to change courts. The current tribunal, the current court, was that of Caesar's. In a very real sense, Festus is only operating as judge at the favor to Caesar. He is simply Caesar's representative. He is responsible to carry out Caesar's will, i.e. the Roman law in this case, upon those who come before him. That was already had happened. Paul points out once again, he has done no wrong, and emphasizes Festus already knows this. No wrong against the Jews, no wrong against any Roman law. In verse 11, Paul basically calls on Festus, pronounce a verdict. I'm either guilty or I'm innocent. And if I'm guilty, Paul says, I'm willing to pay the price, even if that means death. I'm not afraid of justice. He then uses a conditional sentence structure by what, again, he proclaims is innocence. It really could be translated this way. If I am innocent, and I am, and then he goes on with the rest of it, he should be released. No one can bring me and turn me over to my enemies because I'm innocent. That is in violation of Roman justice. So at this point, Paul loses all hope of having a fair Roman trial while he's in Judea. And so as a Roman citizen, he appeals to Caesar. This is known as what is called a provocatio. It's a right of any Roman citizen to make an appeal of a verdict to the highest authority, which is Caesar. It is one of the oldest Roman rights. It actually dates back to 509 B.C. I found that was interesting when setting this out, because a lot of our laws have the same thing based in it. We have right of appeal. It traces all the way back to this law in Roman court. More interesting was the fact that under Augustus and Julius, the law was expanded, and that's what Paul is taking advantage of. It was the right to appeal even before a verdict was given. And once that appeal was made, nothing was to prevent him from going to Rome and that appeal being heard in a reasonable time. That's what Paul's taking advantage of. Now, some have wondered, why would Paul make an appeal to Caesar when the man holding that office this time is Nero? You remember Nero? Nero is the one who became infamous for his actions in 64 and 65 AD when he cruelly burned Christians. He became very against it. He blamed the burning of Rome on Christians and then persecuted them horribly, cruelly. So somebody like, Nero, why would Paul do this? Well, it's because they don't remember that the first part of Nero's reign was actually considered a golden age in Roman history. A large part of that's because he was under the influence of his tutor, a fellow named Seneca. He was a Stoic philosopher. And then another fellow named Afrinius Burrus, who was the prefect of the Praetorian Guard. It's not until later in his reign that he becomes a despot. But early on, it was a golden age in Rome. So Paul had every reason to believe that he'd be vindicated under Roman justice, just as he had before when he was in Corinth. Remember under Galileo? He was vindicated. In fact, Galileo kicked it out of court before Paul even had to answer anything. This is what he was expecting. Yes, he's lost hope. I know I'm not going to get a fair trial while I'm here in Judea. I appeal to Caesar. I'll get one in Rome. Now, after Festus confers with his council as to the correct response to the appeal, he declares the appeal accepted, and he's going to send him to Caesar. The only delay now is waiting for enough people who have to go to Rome, enough prisoners, to justify sending the centurion and the guard detail. He's waiting for transportation. Now, this again shows God's providence upon Paul's life. Remember back in Acts 23:11, the Lord had promised Paul that he was going to go to Rome and witness in Rome for the Lord. That was a promise. Here we find in God's providence that he is going to be sent to Rome under Roman protection and at Roman expense. Paul doesn't even have to pay for it. Now, that's really more of a blessing than you might think, because here he's going to, you know, have to face all the normal perils of travel in the ancient world, and there was going to be those. But Paul had people all around that were anxious to murder him. He had plots all over the place. Remember, when he had been in Corinth last, he went back a different way because there was a plot there to kill him. He would have to travel from Caesarea all the way to Rome and avoid all these people who were plotting to kill him. Instead, he's going to go at Roman expense and under Roman protection. No one was planning to kill him to get to him. This is God's providence. Now, Paul's appeal removes Festus's immediate dilemma about what to do with Paul. He needed to protect Paul. He had to assure that Paul would be safe as a Roman citizen, and yet he didn't want to antagonize the Jews. Well, that's settled. It's out of his hands, and Paul is leaving. Now he has a new dilemma. In such appeals, Caesar relied on the governors and on the council to provide a very full description of the case so they could make judgment. That only makes sense. Festus had nothing to write, or at least very little. What could he write? Now, maybe he had Lysias' letter and had been kept around. Maybe he had the proceedings from Felix's first trial. But all those would show that Paul is innocent. He's still got a problem with, well, then why has he not been freed? So what's he going to write? He has got a dilemma. Now, the opportunity to figure that out comes only a few days later. Look at verse 13. Now, when several days elapsed, King Agrippa and Bernice arrived at Caesarea and paid their respects to Festus. And while they were spending many days there, Festus laid Paul's case before the king, saying, "There's a certain man left a prisoner by Felix, and when I was at Jerusalem, the chief priests and the elders of Jews brought charges against him, asking for a sentence of condemnation upon him. And I answered them that it is not the custom of the Romans to hand over any man before the accused meets his accusers face to face and has an opportunity to make his defense against the charges. And so, after they had assembled here, I made no delay, but on the next day took my seat on the tribunal and ordered the man to be brought. And when the accuser stood up and began bringing charges against him of such crimes as I was not expecting, but they simply had some points of disagreement with him about their own religion, about a certain dead man, Jesus, whom Paul asserted to be alive. And being at a loss how to investigate such matters, I asked whether he was willing to go to Jerusalem and there stand trial in these matters. But when Paul appealed to be held custody for the emperor's decision, I ordered him to be kept in custody until I sent him to Caesar. And Agrippa said to Festus, I also would like to hear the man myself. And so Festus said, tomorrow you shall hear him. Now, this is very good for Festus. Because again, he's ignorant of what's going on. He doesn't understand Jewish religion. He doesn't understand these people. And as it says here, he certainly doesn't understand what this is being talked about, this resurrection. What is that? But several days later, here comes King Agrippa II along with his sister Bernice. And they have come down to welcome Festus. Now, Herod Agrippa reigned in the area north and east of where Festus was. We would call this is a lot of the area of Syria. So they are neighbors, and it would have been a common thing for a new governor comes in, neighboring governors, kings are going to come down, welcome him, and start building relationships so they can work together, because there's always things that you have to do when you're side by side as countries. So that's why they were coming down. Now, he not only had that area, but I should point out that Agrippa also had other territories. Down in Perea, he had an area. And in Jerusalem, he had the right to appoint the high priest. So Agrippa was kind of all over the place. And definitely he was going to have interaction with the new governor. So that's why he's down there. Now, who is this Agrippa? Now, Agrippa, here's a genealogy chart. Agrippa was the brother of Bernice and Drusilla. Drusilla was the wife of Felix, the previous governor. Their father, Herod Agrippa I, was in charge of the Judean era from the early 30s AD to about 44 AD. He is the one that had the apostle John killed. And then he's the one that died by worms. Okay, that's him. He had married off his daughter Bernice to his brother Herod of Chalcis. But Herod of Chalcis died, and Bernice then ends up going back to the court where Agrippa is and ends up kind of an acting queen. In fact, she's called that. So that's where they fit. Her grandfather, Aristobulus, was the son of Herod the Great through his Jewish wife, Mariamne. And so they actually had a Jewish heritage. That was one reason they had interest in all these Jewish things. Herod Agrippa I considered himself Jewish and was very involved. So that's an excellent person for Festus to ask about the affairs of the Jewish people. Here's a guy that really knows. So this is excellent. Well, after several days, Festus Agrippa developed a friendship, and Festus explains this dilemma he's got, Paul's case. He wants to get his opinion. What do I do about this? Maybe you can tell me. Now, what Festus says here, though, is very revealing of his own confusion about the case and also what had been said during the trial that Luke doesn't give us the detail about. Here are the most interesting points. First of all, when the Jews first approached Festus, they weren't asking for a trial. They were asking for a summary judgment. We want you simply to condemn this man. And Festus' response, it's not our custom. We give a man a fair hearing first. And if he's guilty, then we'll condemn him. That's when they start asking, well, then let's have a trial here in Jerusalem. So they were even more of their hatred is being expressed than originally thought. They're asking, just condemn this guy without a hearing. The second thing we come up with in verse 18 is that Festus is surprised by the particular charges that are being made against Paul. That tells us there have been some changes from their initial accusations. It wasn't just those things I mentioned earlier, treason and being the leader of an illegal religion. It had a lot more to do with the religious aspects of this. That has been brought in, which confuses him. And in particular, as verse 19 says, it concerns the resurrection of Jesus Christ. That's very confusing to this man. What people who are dead, alive, they say he's dead. Paul says he's alive. What's this all about? He's clueless. He doesn't understand. It also tells us then that the key conflict between Paul and the Sanhedrin was this one. Remember what Paul had shouted out when he was before the Sanhedrin? I am on trial for what? My hope in the resurrection of the dead. That was the truth. That was the key issue. and specifically the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And so because of this, verse 20 tells us, Festus is at a loss. He has no idea how to proceed. It's a religious question. And that tells us that Paul had correctly appealed to Caesar because Festus had gone outside the bounds of Roman law. He was innocent of anything to do with Roman law and should have been freed immediately as a Roman citizen. Instead, Festus had this interest in involving himself in a religious matter that was not in Roman jurisdiction simply so he could understand the people better. Paul was very wise to appeal to Caesar. Now, at this point, Agrippa expresses his own interest in hearing Paul himself, much as his sister Drusilla had heard him the previous 2 years. And Festus, of course, welcomes this. Maybe he's going to get an idea. What can I write to Caesar? Because I don't know. So verse 23 tells us the proceedings that occur the next day. And so on the next day, when Agrippa had come together with Bernice amid great pomp and had entered the auditorium accompanied by the commanders and the prominent in the city at the command of Festus, Paul was brought in. And Festus said, King Agrippa, and all you gentlemen here present with us, you behold this man about whom all the people of the Jews appealed to me, both at Jerusalem and here, loudly declaring that he ought not to live any longer. But I found that he committed nothing worthy of death, and since he himself appealed to the emperor, I decided to send him. Yet I have nothing definite about him to write to my lord. Therefore I have brought him before you, and especially before you, King Agrippa, so that after the investigation has taken place, I may have something to write. For it seems absurd to me in sending a prisoner not to indicate also the charges against him. Well, much like their father, Agrippa and Bernice enjoy the opportunities to show off their royal positions with pomp and ostentatious displays of their wealth. Now, Agrippa was single. His sister Bernice is living in the court, has taken on basically the role of queen, will have herself called that. In fact, on the coins from that period, she's called that queen. And they come into this auditorium in great pageantry. They're going to be dressed in their royal robes. And then followed them are the Roman military commanders. These would be Chiliarchs, men who are in charge of 1,000 men. You can imagine they're dressed in their finest military garb. And then all the leading men of Caesarea. This is quite a show coming on. Now, the location is not the courtroom. It is the governor's auditorium. It's a whole different location because it's not a trial. So pomp and circumstance and all the rest of it go into this. And then they bring Paul in. And what a contrast. All dressed in their finery, Paul comes in with chains. And yet history will tell us who was the one that was actually important to humanity. The ones with the pomp, the ones with the ostentatious displays of wealth, or the man in chains. Well, Festus uses this opportunity. It's really a way to honor King Agrippa, gain his favor, because he gives them the prestigious positions in the proceedings of this day. Now, Festus begins with an explanation of why he has called the assembly, and then he's going to yield the running of the meeting to Agrippa. That's quite an honor. Now, Festus's introduction is direct. He explains to all present that the Jews were demanding Paul's death, but his investigation revealed he'd done nothing worthy of such a penalty. Again, another statement confirms Paul was innocent. And yet Paul was wise to appeal to Caesar, since Festus wanted to take him to Jerusalem for another trial. And Paul was going to be sent to Caesar, he explains. But he says, I have nothing to write on why he's being sent. And so, that's why we're having this, especially King Agrippa. We're going to investigate, we're going to question Paul, and I have something to write to Caesar. Now he says here, it would seem absurd to send a prisoner to Caesar without indicating the charges. That's more than just absurd. That's dangerous. Can you imagine him sending a prisoner to Caesar and has nothing to say about why he's being sent? That wastes Nero's time. How do you think someone like Nero is going to respond to a governor who just sends people and there's no indication about anything? You may not have your position very long. So he's actually a little on the desperate side to get something to write? Well, again, there's no legal standing for this trial, and it's not a trial. And because it's not, and because Paul had already appealed to Caesar, Paul doesn't have to show up. Paul has absolutely no obligation to help Festus out in this. None. And from a human standpoint, we would say that maybe Paul shouldn't. We might think that. But Paul doesn't have that characteristic, does he? Paul would take advantage of every opportunity to proclaim the gospel. And that's what he saw in this. He's going to have an opportunity to again proclaim the truths of God. Paul was committed to being faithful and proclaiming the truth of God even in the midst of injustice. And that's something we must do as well. Well, next week we will examine the testimony because we're out of time. But that's where we're leaving Paul this time. He's standing in chains before the king and all these people in their pomp. But he has the message. And they're going to listen carefully to what he has to say. And in explaining that next week, we're also going to see how do we give a faithful testimony to Christ. Because this testimony next week is a superb example of exactly how to do that. It gives us a great outline for us to present our own testimony. Father, again, we thank you for your word. And Father, just in seeing what had happened here, your faithfulness. Father, we know that bad things happen to Christians. There are those who hate us. There are those who will lie about us. There are those who will slander us. There will be those who are going to persecute us, even physically. And yet we know that in your providence, you can take any of those circumstances and glorify yourself, even as you did in the life of Paul. And for that, we're grateful because it gives us courage when we face circumstances that are bad in our lives, when we have people do such things to us. Father, that is our desire, is to glorify your name in every situation. In Jesus' name, amen.